Hey, what's up?
Yeah, what's up, dude?
Right, guys, welcome back to the weekly show with me and Ubaid, where we kind of dissect current news and current events. Today, what we're going to talk about is the idea of too big to fail. There's a lot of many large companies and organizations out there, and many of you may have noticed that these companies don't exactly follow all of the rules, or they have a lot of special rules kind of written into them. And what we want to talk about kind of today is look at some of the current news that is happening out in the world and talk about, are we going to see, are we actually going to see banks maybe fail one day because we have different protocols that are put in place? Ubaid, what do you think?
Are we going to see banks fail due to different protocols? Damn. So I don't think. I think what's more likely is you'll see governments fail and then subsequently banks. Because in the last financial crisis, in the Great Recession, what you saw was you saw a domino effect of a lot of different players who had made a lot of risky loans and a lot of risky bets on things that they knew were bad, getting bailed out. But in the process, there was a huge amount of consolidation that happened in the space. And along with that, some of the people were kicked out of the banking boys club, as I like to call it. Particularly, you saw Bear Stearns being allowed to fail. You saw Merrill Lynch being acquired by Bank of America, and you saw a bunch of other consolidation happening across the industry. Wells Fargo being another big player in that. Recently, you see that Wells Fargo has been mired in a variety of different scandals. And then you kind of think about, okay, well, if in the past they were one of the companies that was deemed too big to fail, is that a decision that is reflecting poorly now, given the current, circumstances and how it impacts, people and transactions today globally? And the domino effect there is if you were to allow an institution like Wells Fargo to fail today, it would have a huge impact on the mortgage industry in the United States because they were a huge mortgage lender pretty much for the last 10 years. But even beyond that, that was like the bread and butter of their business. So, a collapse on that end would be a huge blow to the U.S. economy. And I'm not entirely sure it's one that wouldn't prevent a huge economic crash. Like it would have huge ramifications if a company like Wells Fargo were to fail. So you can see how if we couldn't back a company like Wells Fargo or we allowed them to fail, I could potentially see a huge correction in the United States and global economy. So that's why sometimes the Austrian economic view is you kind of let things go and if a business fails, a business fails, but and it's not that simple. There are a lot of more complex plays behind the scenes that we don't necessarily see, but are very important to the well functioning of the U.S. and then in turn the
Yeah, I
global
think,
economy.
yeah, so I kind of sometimes have this debate with like a lot of people back and forth, like this idea of too big to fail, because I totally agree with a lot of like points you made about, if we let Wells Fargo crash and burn, it's going to have a cascading effect on a lot of people's lives and a lot of structures that are put in place, a lot of safety nets, so to speak. But my problem with it is these banks, you see them with so much control. In fact, in the past week, we had a there was a lot of there was a lot of talk with banks, right? We had I think the sixth largest bank bought, they purchased the fourth largest bank. It was like a $66 billion deal. And okay, maybe that's fine, and maybe it's like the spirit of capitalism. But with Wells Fargo, they had a fire in their server room, and what that caused was widespread downtimes internationally and domestic. Like their mobile app was broken, their banking infrastructure was down. People could not see their money, people could not withdraw their money. It was really, really bad. And, you know, maybe they shouldn't, I'm not saying they should, like, get punished for this, but the problem with the whole banking sector is because these banks, you know, they're companies at the end of the day, and I feel like they've been given special privilege if you look in history with the way in which they were treated. And even when, you know, they launder money or they open up fake accounts for customers like Wells Fargo did, they don't get punished. All they do is get fined, and they can afford to pay the fines, and then they kind of move on. And this is where I think the fintech sector is going to disrupt banks, because I understand banks are very large and they can still do a lot of things better than a lot of these fintech companies and products. But people are waking up and realizing that why is it that it takes so long for your money to be sent? I was told it's like anti-money laundering rules so that you can move money back and forth very quickly. But with something like crypto, you can, or like other fintech products. And I think if banks don't start having better track records, I don't see any reason why a person in like 2019, 2020, 2025, as we go along in the years, why would especially millennials not try out alternative to banking? Because there's an app called Cash App. It was created by the company Square. So they basically give you a debit card, and you can send money to any of your you can send money to any of your friends, kind of like Venmo, except you can also send Bitcoin. And your Cash App account, they assign you a routing number, just like a bank. So to some extent, people are like switching over, trying out different things, because either their experience with the bank, you know, wasn't as expected, or it was a really, really bad experience. Like, I try to send, you know, my money that I worked hard for, and maybe my bank denied my request, right? So it's kind of like, why do we have all these restrictions and silos for a bank? Like banking specifically, banking is the only thing that that people every day have to ask permission to use their own money for, right? You don't ask permission to use your own car because you own it. You don't ask permission for anything else. But like, I was in the bank the other week, like one or 2 weeks ago, and you know, I was trying to withdraw some money, but I kind of had to like explain. I didn't have to explain what it was for, but they at least asked me a couple of questions. I hadn't been in a bank for, you know, a couple of weeks and months prior to that. I just think I don't think banks right now will be what they are in the future. I think we'll have some type of bank, but what it is right now is definitely not working. You know, it's either I think, to put it simply, it's banks are too centralized right now with information, with the back-end infrastructure, and the amount of control they have.
Yeah, so there's so many different points to address right there, and they're all very, very good. So I think I'd like to start with fintech is definitely disrupting the banking sector for a couple of different reasons. One is for some of the things you just mentioned, like quicker access to your money, you know, more transparency into the kind of products you're getting, and, you know, like a direct transactional experience. Whereas with a bank, you kind of have more of a longer drawn out, you know, in the past it was more, you know, relationship banking. Now it's much more, it's becoming quick touch and go, and they're offering a variety of different avenues to access, you know, their products. But more importantly, I think the really big thing that a lot of people are tending to ignore is that fintech simplifies the product selection process for what you're looking for in a financial institution. And what I mean is, if there are times where you go to, I haven't opened up a bank account in a while, so I don't know if this is, you know, still true today, but I remember when I was opening up my first bank account, I had to open up a checking account with it, right? You know, there are a variety of fintech companies that allow you to, you know, bank with them, and you don't have to open up a savings account. You know, a good example is like Barclays. Barclays is obviously a huge bank player, but the online savings is a leading player in the, you know, savings field, and you don't have to open up a checking account. Similarly, you know, in terms of providing identity, that's another big thing that banks do is they help provide you identity. They also give you a place for your job to, you know, deposit their money. And the thing about fintech is they are finding innovative ways to do the same thing. And if you take it on a global level, there are a lot of people who don't have some sort of digital identity or footprint. And fintech companies like Tala allow that identity to be created. So there really is a lot of innovation that's coming along that's allowing people to change the way that their financial and then also personal identity is thought of. As far as banks themselves, you know, and the large processes they have in place, it is a very old, archaic infrastructure. Anybody who has done any sort of, you know, consulting or advisory for banks understands how much regulation there is involved, how much, you know, back-end work that is still going on in very old, archaic ways. You know, it's just there's a wide plethora of things that could cause these issues. Now, when you think about something like serving millions and millions of customers and then your entire data center being, you know, compromised, that's a huge deal, right? Because you think about speed and agility and the ability to deliver services, and that all of that is compromised. Not to mention you have a terrible reputation in the view of the customers today because of all the scandals they had. And it becomes a very dicey situation. Then you can see why people tend to trust banks less. But at the end of the day, you go back to that concept of, is this company too big to fail? Do we still need to rely on them for the health and prosperity of the, you know, the U.S. economy? And, you know, unfortunately, the answer just continues to be
Yeah, I think the answer is still yes for now, because the way banks were structured into our economy and, like, into our governance, kind of, like, if you go really high up the chain, you know, you'll eventually reach, like, central banks. And so what I wanted to talk about a little bit was, do you think that financial, like, literacy is improving? Well, obviously it is, right? But what I mean is, do you think there's kind of like an awakening where people are, I shouldn't say maybe financial literacy, maybe like monetary literacy, like people are slowly understanding now what does a bank account actually mean? You know, why are these weird things happening in other parts of the world? Like in France, there was something there in France, the citizens of France tried to engage in a bank run, which is basically when you get a large part of the population in a country, and everybody goes and, like, in the same day withdraws all the money out of their bank account in, like, in paper currency, fiat. But the only problem with that is the banks don't have that much reserve on hand to give out all that money. So it doesn't mean that they don't have the money somewhere, but banks do lend out money as well. And sometimes when they make bad decisions, then, like, if they're not able to give everyone their money on the same day, they're just going to stop functioning to some extent. So the banks actually did close in France, but I guess that's sort of a different topic. My main point was, like, I feel like this rise of fintech or even cryptocurrency, people are really interested with money, and they're really taking the time now more than ever to understand, like, what money is. And because a large segment of the, like, older generation or even the younger generation, you aren't really taught a lot of these things in school. Even if you're in college, if you don't take any of these, like, economics or business classes, you're not really taught a lot about, like, why things are structured the way they are. And that's what I think is so interesting about, like, these cryptocurrency protocols. They're created as a alternative for if this, like, this current infrastructure we have, if things go south again, we don't have to just sit there and, you know, wait for things to recover. We can actually shift it, you know, shift some of the financial activity onto these, like, cryptocurrency protocols and still carry on. And I think, you know, just plainly put, out in the world right now, like, if you see a country like Venezuela, like every week on end for the past month, the weekly volume for local Bitcoins has been exploding, increasing week by week. And for those of you that don't know, local Bitcoins is basically this website, like all over the world. They have, wherever you are, you can basically find, you can meet with someone in person and like just buy Bitcoin that way through cash. I think it's really interesting. You don't even need like an exchange or anything, right? There's so many different ways to acquire Bitcoin, but I do see this change or this shift happening, because if it was not happening, you wouldn't have as many people like eager to at least experiment and try these different tools available. Like, let's call them fintech tools.
Right. So the name of the game in the 21st century is transparency, right? Everybody wants transparency and access because information is widely available everywhere, right? You can go on Google and pretty much find anything you want. If you really want to understand how a banking process works, you can find it on the internet. So with that knowledge in mind, financial institutions and companies all across the world are becoming more transparent into a lot of their different things. So it's becoming much harder from a competition standpoint to just succeed only on information alone. But then the other side of it is from a consumer standpoint, there is an eagerness and a willingness to not only try and experiment with new products, but also just learn about different things. And then that comes from this wide array of sources that are available to help educate the consumer. And that's only going to grow. And with that, you see there's less, 30, 40 years ago, our parents would have only stayed with one bank at our age. But with us, if we're not
Yeah, that's
comfortable, we're going to
interesting.
leave,
So
right?
you have kind of like
Not.
the more of like a freedom of choice, but I wanted to ask you one more thing. So like as we're talking about too big to fail, like so like which side should we kind of believe, Ubaid? Like, if the banks are making 66, $70 billion deals, and then you have these fintech startups trying to disrupt these huge banks, like, which side is going to win in the end, and can we live in a world where both can coexist? Like, or what are banks going to be? Because what are their play? What are their play? We talked a little bit about their place in the world now. How is that place going to change in the future? How are banks going to evolve? I want you to talk a little bit about that.
Wow, that is a great question. That is that, and I think it's been something that a lot of people have been thinking about, because you not only have to think about the role of the small banks, the mom and pop shop, and the higher level banks, but you also have to think about the role of, federal institutions and how, what their role will be in the economy. So, it kind of starts from the top. You have a central banking system, that kind of dictates how the rest of these players work. There's a lot of heavy regulation that happens that changes how these banks are working. And as that regulation changes, banks will either adopt or they won't. Now, when you think about these fintech disruptors who are, looking to gain a piece of that market share and serve more customers, they really have to not only be able to do the transactions at scale and provide those services always, always available, always on time. And just serving to every customer's need. I think Accenture had released a report, and the new digital services are individualized to the customer, yet always available. And you think about that sort of mindset, and when you think about things like banking, like that's a huge shift, right? Today in digital banking, you can access most services, but how about the opportunity to do things that like how about the opportunity to close a house or get a loan online on a Saturday
Yeah,
night?
that's very interesting, yeah.
Like you see what I'm saying? So banks in the future will have to have that sort of mindset. Kind of like you look at retail. Retail is completely omni-channel, or at least any player worth their salt is omni-channel. And what that means is customers can get their products and services at any time from many different places. And banks need to be able to do the same thing. And if they don't, then they will. Then in moving forward, I can definitely see market share being eaten away rapidly if they don't proactively adopt that mindset. You also have to think about the role of technology and things like chatbots and how that will change the customer service experience, right? Banks with huge infrastructure still have a reason to have, you know, people in the store. Or sorry, not people in the store, but people in the bank, the actual retail branch. But a fintech company like Robinhood has no need for it.
Yeah.
Everything can be done through a chatbot. Everything can be done because the customer understands this experience is something that's already individualized. I already know exactly what I need and how to get it. And I already know the moment I do that, my services or whatever I'm looking for will be available to me. So how can banks think about that moving forward? I mean, they are. They are rapidly innovating. You see a lot of different branch layouts. You see a lot of different interactions. You see a lot of, you know, they're becoming much more personalized because for them, that's their name of the game. But when you go to a higher level, that's at the local consumer. When you think at the higher level, you think about how are people going to be lending money to each other in a very volatile and hostile world, especially when people are starting to close off their borders, right? You think about Brexit, right? A lot of people don't understand Brexit isn't just about immigration. Brexit is also a reappropriation of Britain's funds. They were, in their minds, propping up most of the European economy. So for them, while initially they may see a shock to GDP, I think the expectation is long-term down the road, they will see a rise because they're kind of funding and bankrolling themselves. And London is a huge financial epicenter of the world. Actually, to me, I think it's even more important than the financial center in New York because their trading sessions actually happen first. Financial news in the world actually occurs there first before it hits New York City. We're talking about a five-hour time gap. 5 hours for financial transactions is huge. Yeah. You think about the role that, central banks and then these big fiduciary banks are going to have moving forward, I think it definitely changes. Because the economy itself is going to become much more rapid and agile and much more individualized rather than centralized. So when you think about the role of a financial institution in keeping that machine running, it becomes completely different. And to me, it then becomes, well, these big institutions may need to break up or they may need to become available to always deliver their services at any time in any part of the world in order for them to, kind of like a Google model, right? Like in order for you to use Google, all you have to do is open the website and that's it, right? It is literally always on point, always available, always delivering. How can banks do the same thing? And I think that's the mindset shift they need to have moving forward in order for them to not be completely disrupted by fintech companies. This is not even thinking about cryptocurrency,
right.
And the role that will play. I'm talking specifically just fintech-based startups such as Robinhood, Tala.
Yeah, you made a lot of good points, especially with comparing the Amazon situation. Like consumer habits and consumer behavior is changing so much, but the financial world is still like so old and archaic. Things are still not instant. And I think that would you say that we have the technology right now to kind of make it instant, but like the government and some of these other regulatory bodies are kind of I think they're being very careful about what they allow and don't allow in the sense of, like some of the rules and structures of why like the financial system is very slow is because to prevent things like money laundering and to prevent scams and other things like that. So I think it'll be really interesting to see how these banks deal with these products because they have the infrastructure and they have the money. But I think it's going to come down to maybe who can do it better at scale. And just because the banks have all of these other pluses going for them doesn't mean that they'll be the ones to do it. And I basically have this viewpoint because, you know, I was just reading a lot about these large companies like Blockbuster or even Yahoo that during the internet age, right, one could say they're too big to fail. But eventually they did crumble and eventually they did fail only because they did not change. So I think it's not like too big to fail. I think if it's like, I think it's more along the lines of like, if you don't change, you'll fail. Like, you need to, like, every single entity, organization, company always needs to keep changing and cater toward like what do customers want right now. That's all it comes down to. If, because at the end of the day, customers just want their money faster, more secure. But also banks, I think, are going to make this change even faster because their incentive is to reduce the amount of fraud and scams that go on, right? They lose so much money annually per year just with these things. So if they can reduce that too, you know, like both sides will be happy. So, but I guess they're, to kind of end it off with me, I think there'll always be companies and organizations like in our society that everybody will kind of view as too big to fail. Like Google is like highly centralized to some extent, and we, none of us can really imagine like Google just going down for the day. There's a lot of, or even something like Amazon. I think Amazon has reached that point. Almost every single, even the government and almost every single public and private company, like majority of them use AWS for all of their hosting. So I think like this too big to fail concept is, does exist in the world, but only to the extent of like, there's always like shifts, like technological shifts or shifts in information like we're going through right now. So as these shifts happen, all these companies have to reevaluate themselves. And that's why we see these new giants like Netflix and even Robinhood. These were all like startups. And now they're getting to the point where they're growing and actually competing with some of the largest banks in the world.
It will be interesting. And that's actually that's a unique concept for technology. Are tech companies too big to fail? Maybe that's probably something we could talk about next week.
Yeah.
So definitely curious to hear what our listeners think about this. Feel free to comment or leave your thoughts in the links that we post.